Now that we have established what derivations actually are, we are already pretty close to what the typical desired output for our parser phase in the compiling process should actually be. So if you have a look at how derivations take place, you can treat them as trees, as the derivation trees. And that is already a very structured view on the input. And the input is what you actually find on the leaves of such a tree. So these things are so far been just a classified token stream, and now you can find them at the leaves of such a structural tree. And the particular inner nodes of that tree all correspond to applications of rules. So if you take, for example, this particular tree here, then you can interpret that as, for once, the root node of that particular subtree, which we have labeled with T0 here, is corresponding to the left-hand side of a rule that belongs to the non-terminal T. And the children of that particular subtree, which would be these ones here, you can interpret them as the right-hand side of the alternative each of these non-terminals have or might have several alternatives, how you can rewrite them. And for alternative zero, that's what you find in here in this inner node, you will find the right-hand side, which you can see over here, which is the T, and then the terminal star or times, and then the non-terminal F. So that's actually exactly the right-hand side of one of the alternatives, the one with the number zero. So you find direct correspondences between the way that the subtrees are actually structured to the rules that you specified before. So that, what you see here, is already kind of the structure that you specified beforehand. So that would be the ultimate goal to get out from our parser phase. So before we go over to how to generate them, let's have a look at a few important things, especially related to uniqueness of results and determinism in what we actually compute. So, before, we've seen that there was a typical derivation tree. We didn't talk about how exactly we went on to derive certain parts of that. As we thought, well, it's just derivations. You can pick wherever you want. However, you can imagine that there are situations where you can generate differently shaped trees, although you still have in the leaves the same token stream for both of these differently shaped derivation trees. So in order to come to a unique derivation tree, there's several ideas to go for, and there's, for example, the one for rewriting always the leftmost non-terminal that we can find in a so far derived fragment, or even the rightmost occurrence of a non-terminal. So these are two ways of making your derivation unique. And as these are so important, they also have names, and these are the leftmost or rightmost derivations. And this leftmost and rightmost is the term that is responsible for this L&R index that you're going to find on the next few chapters quite a lot of times. So there's, we come to that. So keep in mind, leftmost and rightmost derivations are the causes why they are called L and R in certain spots. Okay. These things, these derivation trees that you got or that you get from leftmost or rightmost derivations also have a certain correspondence to depth-first searches if you just descend through these trees, always using the left children before you descend through right children. You will get a pre-order depth-first traversal with left-to-right precedence, and if you choose right-to-left precedence, you'll get depending on which of these you prefer. So you can arrange that in a way that you like, but with that you get, instead of a tree, you'll get a sequence of triggered callbacks in your depth-first search. And that is actually what you'll get in most of the parser generators as your interface to act like you want to configure your parser yourself. So what you get from parser generators is you specify your grammar rules on one side, and for each of these rule alternatives, you get action code, which is kind of just a callback possibility, a hook into a depth first run through the derivation tree of your actual input. So that's what you're going to get out of your parsing generator. One particular other thing seems to be a little bit twisted and the wrong way around, but also plays an important role, which is this. It's the reverse rightmost derivations, and that is something that that corresponds to a left to right post order depth first traversal. Well, that sounds a little bit strange at the first point, but all that you get with that is, in principle, a traversal of your derivation tree, not from top to bottom, but from bottom to top. So that's just another way of traversing your derivation tree. Let's see an example of that. So that is the derivation tree that we've discussed about before. And you can either look at the traversal that we so far would probably consider as the most intuitive one. So you would go to leftmost depth first search pre-order, which would mean that you would go that direction through the whole tree. And that's going to get you the callbacks or actions. First of all, E0, that is when descending through the root node, then E1, descending through here, T0, descending here, T1, descending here, F1, and so on. So these traces that you find over there are kind of just the trace of callbacks through the depth-first search in the leftmost derivation. To get you a feeling of what it looks like if you go rightmost first, you see that trace over here. So the root is still the same. Still, we've gone from the top to the bottom. But instead of going to E1, we will now choose rightmost first, and that will lead to matching this one, going through this one, then going through there, and so on. So that's just the other priority. And the twisted one now, the reverse rightmost derivation, now looks completely different. So if you look at it from, well, reverse, if you look at it from the back, then this would just be the same one as we had before. So T1, F2, over here, E1, over here, and so on. if you look at it from the beginning, then you'll get this bottom-up view on the whole derivation tree. So you'll see at first F1 being visited, then T1, which will be this one. And now before we go to T0, we will go to F2. And only now that we have completed all the children, we will then in the end visit the T0, like this. So yeah, for that, we have visited all the children, so we can match this one. Then we need to build the next subtree in order to match for the E0. So we will find F2, T1, and in the end, E0. So that's a bottom-up run through the whole derivation tree. This seems kind of arbitrary in the beginning, but this has important consequences on how the actual parsing engines are going to work, because that determines what part of the input the parser engine will actually be able to use in order to do certain decisions that will get rid of non-determinism in the end. So keep that in mind. We will use that later on when we talk about these two parsing algorithms. Then the next big thing is uniqueness. We need to talk about a unique derivation tree in order to actually be able to reason about what the programmer actually meant when he wrote down some kind of source code. So if there's non-unique grammars that lead to two different derivation trees for the same input, then we won't have an exact meaning of what the programmer actually meant with that part of source code. So unique grammars are important. And the thing is that how we're going to define unique grammars is that we will have a look at the actual outcome, which is found in the leaves, and we call that the yield of derivation tree. So that will be just the leaves concatenated to each other so that there's no non-terminal anymore in the input. And that will be the so-called yield of the derivation tree. And the thing is that we will define a grammar as unique if for every possible input, if we consider all the derivation trees that actually yield that specific input, then the grammar is unique if there's only one derivation for that. What does that mean in an example? Well, we have had this special or particular grammar for arithmetic expressions before already. You've seen that there's several of them. There's the version over here and the version over there. The second one is the one that is actually unique. The first one is actually ambiguous. Well, it stands here, but can you actually see or give me an example where the first one is actually ambiguous? Int plus int,
yeah.
Times int, like this. Yes. Oh, well.
Then you first have to make a derivation for int plus int, and then you you have it for yes. The times. Like, yeah, it's an e.
And
first grammar. Yeah.
Well, it was not the best choice of color, but yeah. Well, there's also, well, there should be a small e before I actually connect all of them, so another mistake. Like this. So I omitted one of these levels, but yeah. And depending on which of the branches you take first, you will end up in different syntax trees. However, you still have the same input sequence. So yeah, that's something that's clearly not desirable as well. Arithmetic is already the best example for that. You intend the particular operators to have different binding and different meaning. And yeah, that will lead to different results in the end when you try to apply that to certain inputs. So yeah, that's clearly not desirable. So these are grammars that we would like to completely remove from possible candidates for our parsers. So these are grammars that we won't use in that form. Instead, we will concentrate on the unique ones. This will lead to a few problems when you start to actually create meaningful parser in the end, because you will have to fight against against the way that you specify your grammars, so that you can in the end get rid of the non-unique parts of that, and you'll have to reformulate a few of these productions maybe to something which might at the first point look a little bit unusual and unintuitive, but well, you'll have to do so in order to come up with a unique grammar. But more for that later on. So for the first part, it's just important to know that there's unique grammars and non-unique grammars, and yeah, it depends on how many different derivations you can find for a certain sequence of terminals. Okay, so a derivation tree. That's the kind of the summarizing the whole thing, is what's actually representing a possible structure of a word. Well, for program languages, we will focus on the grammars that only make unique derivation trees possible for a fixed input. And yeah, there's a correspondence between these trees and sequences of derivations. And yeah, depending on the way you walk through such a tree, you will end up with different kinds of derivations. So that's what you should take away from that. Yeah. Okay, good. Moving along, there's yeah, that's what I've also told you. There's this top-down reconstruction of a syntax tree, which will correspond to these leftmost derivations. And then there's this bottom-up principle of trying to reconstruct the syntax tree, which will correspond to that weird reverse rightmost derivations concept. So now that we have talked about grammars, let's move on to the actual implementation, which is what we want to generate in the end from a parser generator. That will be a pushdown automata, as there's a direct correspondence between context-free grammars and pushdown automata. What we actually want is, well, a thing that has a pointer to the input, which can run through the whole input, and will also support a pushdown where we can store intermediate results. And the typical uses for that were, well, if you think back to theoretical computer science, you had always had these examples of matching braces, and Yeah, that's already pretty close to what you also find in programming languages, where you have this begin-end structure with the curly brackets, and or begin-end quite literally in your, what was it, Pascal or something. So that's already the structures that you typically find in computer programming languages. So that promises to be a quite a useful tool. So let's have an example. Let's look at what we typically have as a pushdown automaton, and yeah, what you find when you look at such a thing is, well, there will be states. For states, we just use, well, numbers for now. And for a pushdown automaton, what you also need is a start state to get you running somewhere. And then there's final states that determine that you're finished with your computation. So far, nothing too spectacular. You also find such things in finite automata. Then, sure. Then there's the transition function. That's something you find over here. You have to read that line by line to get your transition. So what we find here is, for example, the first line consists of three components. In the middle, you'll find the component that is able to carry terminal as the input symbol. That's what's going to be consumed from the input. Potentially one character, or if you have a non-deterministic transition, then also just an epsilon. And the other things that we find over here is to the left, a string from the states, and to the right also a string from the states. And what that's going to be used for is actually for matching the top few slots of your pushdown. So when I write a transition like this one, what I actually mean is that in case that the top of my pushdown matches or has the same has a suffix that matches this first component, in this case the zero, and if the input to be found there is actually an A, then what I'm going to do is I will take the thing that I have matched on the top of the pushdown and replace it with the string that I find over here. So this will mean that I will, in case that my top of stack is just zero and the input is an A, I will replace the zero with two ones. And same way you will have to read all the other lines. So let's have a look at an example. There's one point for the people at home. So yeah, that might look a little bit odd for you. I don't know how you got introduced to pushdown automata. A few definitions separate between the states and the actual content of the stack. So there's pushdown symbols and state symbols. For our purposes, we don't need to be so complicated. We actually, for just parsing input, we don't need to differentiate between those things. So that's what we're going to do. We will not differentiate between those two. And if you now ask for where you actually find your state, then, well, you'll find the state as the upper pushdown symbols, and the actual transitions now just consist in consuming the upper part of the pushdown, or rewriting, or removing, or adding just to that. So, some kind of manipulation on the top of the pushdown will be what the transitions do on the whole system. Okay, so to get a little bit more into the formal stuff, let's have a look at what Bauer and Samuelson have found to be the core components of these pushdown automata. So they say for a pushdown automaton, you need five components. Well, the ones that you've seen already on the slide before is, well, you need a set of states. So that's what you're going to do with Q. Then what you're also going to need is to need to select a certain start state from your set of possible states Q, Q0. That's another specific component. Then you also choose the final states from your set of states. That's going to give you your set F of final states. Then you also need to carry consumable input characters in your transition relation. For that, you'll need to specify the set of input symbols that are admissible for your transition function. And of course, in the end, what you're going to need is the actual transition function, which will be just a subset of. I put the frame not around the whole thing, which will be just a tuple of non-empty string of states, which will then be matched to the top of the pushdown. That is this one here. Then what you also find will be the new top of stack. That's what you find as the last component of your transition relation. And then, of course, in case you match something with the input, you will have to mention that here as an input symbol. Or in case you have a non-deterministic transition here, you also have an empty string. So that's what's going to contribute to your transition relation. Yeah, so that is the core components for the whole thing. Now, how does a pushdown automaton actually work? For that, we need to look at machine states or computations of a pushdown automata. So for that, we need to have a look at the computation state. So how does that look like? Well, it's actually just a pair of the things that might change during the run through an input. And what will that be? Well, that will be, for example, the content of the pushdown at that specific moment. So that's going to be a string from the states. And the other part that's going to change is that's going to be relevant for the termination of the whole thing, is the remaining input. And that is going to be a string taken from, the set of terminal symbols. So those two make up the configuration or computation state of a pushdown automaton. So let's do the example now. So that's the same thing that you've seen on the slides before. Let's try it out on a certain input. And I've mentioned on the last few slides already that there's this matching braces, and if you have a look at what you see over here, then, well, that already reminds you a lot of the a matching braces problem, I think. So, yeah, you might find that already known at some point. Anyway, so let's have a look at what the actual automaton does here. So our configuration consists of the pushdown, which is initialized just with this start state. So it's zero so far. What am I to do now? I have to match with the left-hand side of the transition relations, and well, that's the only line that I find that matches the first component with the something that's found on the stack or on the pushdown. Well, the next thing that I have to match is the first remaining input symbol, and it's already chosen this line, so I just have to verify whether I find an A over here. So that's good so far. So now I can perform an action, which will then modify the configuration of my pushdown. So that's going to introduce something new. That's going to be a computation step, which opens a new configuration. So what's the thing that I'm going to find here?
It's 11 and AABB.
11, so that's what I take from here. 11, okay. And the next thing, well, you've already said it, it's consumed the A, so I will find AABBB. Correct? Yeah, correct. So, next thing. Let's just continue until we find a final state, or possibly not, if the input doesn't correspond to our machine. So, what line will be matched? So there's two possibilities now.
Yeah. But it has also the B consumes the A, so we're left with the first.
Exactly. So we have possibly several candidates here, as we can match the top of stack with either just the top of stack one, or it might even match with the whole pushdown over here, which is just the 11. And those two choices are reflected in these two lines. And we have to further shrink down the selection. We can do that in this case with the input, which is the A. And this will lead to, well, once again, replacing the top of stack with 11. And consume one of the A's. So, well, now it's not so difficult. It's exactly the same situation as before. Just now, the thing is, we don't need to match with the complete pushdown now, but with the suffix of the pushdown. So either with 11 or with 1. And once again, it's going to lead to the same thing. So we're going to replace and have even more ones on the push down. But now the difference that the first input symbol has changed. So even though we still now match with 1 or 11, which will still match with either this one or this one, we will now have a change in behavior due to the changed input, and this will now select the second alternative. And now we're going to run into the completely different direction, as now instead of putting more symbols on the pushdown, we will now reduce the number of symbols on the pushdown, and also switch over to a suffix of 2. So this will reduce the number and also consume input. Yes, please?
So now we would read the pushdown stack from right to left, right? So is that correct?
That is something that is, of course, something that you have to somehow define. And in our case, the pushdown grows from the left and shrinks from the right. So top of stack of pushdown or stack is to be found on the right-hand side. Yeah. So that's what kind of this example also should provide. But it actually doesn't matter too much for the definitions that come later on. So you can also always find a formulation so that the whole thing is reversed. It just depends on how you define the whole thing. And yeah, so far we haven't done any formal definitions anyway, so that's just a matter of defining that. Okay, anyway, and now matching is a little bit easier, as we have only one candidate here, which has a 2 in any way. So matching, that will be without doubt. We just have to verify that the input is admissible for that thing, and that's going to be the case. So we will be able to match with the same rule once again and once again. until we at the end have consumed the complete input. And yeah, it happens to be that our only remaining pushdown symbol is, well, it's just one symbol that's still on the pushdown, and it happens to be one of the final state symbols. So, well, it's pretty fine for our purposes, I would say. We have a final state, so the word that we were given in the beginning, obviously, is part of the language that's recognized with that particular pushdown machine. Fine so far. That's how the whole system rolls. So back to formal things now. Now that we have seen how these computational steps actually work, let's start to find an actual definition of what this operator that we have used so far is actually defined. So this computational step operator is a relation between tuples of, well, why do I say tuples and not tuple? Well, that's because of there's a small square over here, so actually two of them. So it relates tuples of the form, at first it carries the pushdown content, and the second component of the tuple carries the some symbols from the input, and it's exactly then a computational step if the two configurations the two configurations for which we want to establish the computational step relations look in like a specific way. So there's conditions on how the pushdown part has to look. Especially, there needs to be a common prefix of the pushdown, which needs to remain the same for both configurations. The only part of the pushdown that is allowed to change is actually the suffix. So that's this one. And there's also restrictions on how the suffix is able to change. And that is determined by looking over here into the transition relations. We have predetermined a certain set of transitions. And only if we can find those two suffixes in the configurations reflected in a transition, then the whole thing is going to be valid. And the next thing that needs to be fulfilled is, well, looking at the part of the remaining input, like there needs to be a common suffix. So we can't at some point just shuffle the remaining input around. We have to talk about exactly one input. The only thing that's allowed to change is one symbol from the input, and that's the one that we have as prefix of the first component of the whole thing. And this exact symbol needs to be a member of the same transition that we have talked before that would match with the changing suffixes of our configurations. And only if these three things that we have located inside these two configurations now match with one particular transition, only then have we a valid computational step. Yeah, so that's just formalizing the things that we have done so far in an intuitive way. We already have correlated these configurations in the example before and intuitively already followed exactly that specification, changing only the suffix of the push down as well as the first symbol of the remaining input. And we did that according to one of our transitional relation things. Okay. And with that definition now, you also have predetermined which side of the pushdown is the one that is manipulated. So you always manipulate from the right-hand side, always the suffix. So that's where the whole thing comes from. Good. Well, this relation now was one that we simply denoted with just this plain operator over here. But of course, well, that's highly dependent on what our transition actually looks like. So in principle, we would have to somehow declare that relation in always in relation to a specific automaton. So I should, if I talk about several automata, I would need to annotate that with exactly the automaton that I want this computational step to belong to. However, as in most cases, we will only talk about just one particular automaton. It will be somewhat clear how what I refer to later on. So I will just leave that away and will just write the operator without that thing. Then, of course, I could do several of these steps one after each other, same as we have done in the case of just the finite automaton. And same as in that case, we'll just indicate that kind of behavior by just adding the clean star to the step operator. So it's like that. And with all that in mind, we can now define what the actual semantics of such an automaton looks like, because now we have the means to express that in a formal way. So the idea would be to have a look at input words like that, and we will treat the set of all input words that will fulfill the condition that we're going to talk about later on. We will take only that condition into the set of words that we mean to express the language that corresponds to our specific automaton. Now, what is the condition that these words need to fulfill? Well, we will put them into the input part of the configuration for our machine, together with the specific start state Q0, and we will do arbitrary many computation steps. That's what we have introduced with the definition above. So that's this step operator in arbitrarily often. And in case that we somehow are able to reach a configuration that has a specific form, namely the configuration where the complete input is gone, so we have empty string on the remaining input. And the next thing is that our pushdown also has a specific shape. For once, it is not a list anymore, but it's just a singleton. It's just one remaining state. And also, the state needs to be a final state. So it needs to be found in the set of final states. So it's kind of a straightforward definition. What we have defined here is that all the words on which our machine just performs computational steps and in the end reaches a final state, then that will be a word that's admissible for the language of our automaton. Nothing more. It's just with a lot of formal definitions over here. I didn't get that from an odd.
So the process of extracting data types from a high level program, like tokens that are recognized by the language, does that fall under this category where we parse the program for keywords?
That's general parsing, not only for keywords. You can try to come up with a grammar that that encompasses your whole language. The only thing that you can't make sure of is that, well, you will also have this machine or the particular machine that with which you come up will also, for example, recognize source programs as valid input, although you might at some point do something which is not type safe. So types are things that are kind of context information for language constructs. And the only thing that will be recognized with this is whether you confine to the right structure. And structure is something which is not context dependent. So, yeah. There's the boundary for that. But apart from that, we'll get language fragments that at least confine to the structure of the whole thing. So structural properties are the ones that can be recognized with that. We'll deal with the other things later on. So, yeah, last line for just final states and empty inputs. That's what the final configurations of our machine looks like. Yeah, so so far what we have seen is how general pushdown automata work. We haven't come up with a definition for how pushdown automata needs to look like in order to be deterministic. So far, we could just choose one of these potential matches in our table of transitions and could just choose an arbitrary one. So what do we have to do to make the whole algorithm deterministic? Would be, well, we had to make sure that the transition table only carries entries that cannot be misunderstood and have to be chosen non-deterministically. So that's the whole way of how to specify a deterministic automaton. And you have to do that by looking at the at transitions and compare each of them. So in case that we have a pair in our transition table, then we have to make sure that in case that, first of all, let's look at the input push down content. So these are the push down contents of the top of the push downs on which this transition applies. So in case that we have the situation that transition delta 1 has a certain suffix gamma 1 and delta 1 prime, well, we should talk about delta and delta prime, has a suffix gamma prime. No, has a suffix gamma prime, yes. And in case that both of them overlap in the sense that gamma 1 is a suffix of gamma 1 prime. So in case that one of those two is a suffix of the other, then if we just see the larger of those two on the top of the stack, then we actually don't know which of these will have to be selected for actions. And we have to consider the second component of our transition, which is this input symbols. And now, in order to decide what we should do with the input, we have to make sure that the second input, at least, now has to be different from each other. So we will have to require for each of these transitions, in case that the top of the stack part of the transitions are in suffix relation to each other, then at least the second part needs to be different. So that's what this does. So x has to be different from x prime, and well, naturally also we still have the possibility for non-deterministic epsilon transitions in our thing, and that would mean that one of both if one of both would be epsilon, then also that would lead to ambiguous choices here. So in that case, we also require that the input part needs to be non-empty. So these are the two things that we need to require in order to make our transitions deterministic. Yeah. In our example, well, can you spot any situation where we could get the idea that there would be a possible non-deterministic choice? So the only part where there's actually a suffix thing is over here. Well, I cannot really align them properly.
Right.
Yeah, but it would be this one and this one. So there's a match in suffixes here. The one is a suffix of the other. So, but you also resolved the whole thing already? With
yeah, there's symbols of difference.
Yeah, so in this case, someone made sure that at least the second component is now different. So in case that this would be the same symbol, we would have an ambiguity which would have to be resolved non-deterministically, and yeah, whole system would be non-deterministic. So for our automaton, we could say, yeah, it's a deterministic automaton. Okay, thinking back to theoretical computer science, we might recall one of the central theorems of this whole Chomsky hierarchy and talking about relating certain grammars with certain automata. And what we get there is that for each context-free grammar, there's we can find a pushdown automaton such that both of them talk about the same language. That's very nice for us because that gives us actually tools to work with. We just need to actually perform that. We actually have to just find the automaton that matches the grammar that we specify for our programming language. Can you remember how to do that from back then? How can you create a pushdown automaton that finds or that recognizes the same input as a certain particular non-deterministic context insensitive grammar? No tricks up your sleeves. Does that ring a bell? Sorry? Yeah, yeah. So these are the names. You also remember what they did? That was a pretty non-deterministic algorithm that they did. So they did a, you could do that by just exploring all the paths that this non-deterministic algorithm would perform. So you would get an exponential time algorithm in the end. But in fact, you could come up with a construction, and that was by try and error, assigning all possible subsequences of your input a right-hand side of a rule, and do so exhaustively such that everything is matched, and then try to match on the second level with just the roots of these subnodes once again and again and again, and do that for all the combinations that are out there. And in case one of these things reaches a step where every input symbol has a connection to our root symbol, and this root symbol corresponds to our start symbol of the grammar, then we're done and have found the thing, and all the others we can just discard. So that was what this CYK was actually about. So, yeah, as you can imagine, matching all things exhaustively and performing all the combinations that are out there is something which is already sounds quite... quite straining, and for the computer it's all the same. It's it has a very bad runtime performance, but it's just for theoretical purposes. You can show that there's a construction that will lead to an automaton that does the same as the grammar. So much for this CYK. Yes. For DFA, I'm just a little bit confused about the DFA now. Where does that come from?
Because if you have a context-free grammar in whatever form, you can reform it into a DFA. Because they are just.
How do you do that? With DFA, you mean deterministic final automaton? Or do you mean a deterministic pushdown automaton?
It could be that I mix something up. One question. Can you have context-free grammar always in a DFA?
If by DFA you mean a finite automaton that doesn't have a pushdown or a stack.
Well, we mix something up.
Maybe. But maybe to have a short preview or sneak into what comes, you also can't construct deterministic pushdown automaton for every context-free grammar anyway. So maybe that's something that, yeah. But so much later for later on. Yeah, the things that we are going to concentrate now is something which can be computed in much less time than the CYK, essentially in linear time. And for that, we have two possible approaches that we're going to explore now. There's, for once, the automata generation algorithms that will make the automaton try to go leftmost derivations from top down, and the other idea would be to create pushdown automata that try to do try to infer trees from bottom to top, thus leading to reverse rightmost derivations in their output. So these are the two ideas: either come down from up above, or go up from bottom to top. So, as these are two little different approaches, we will focus on each of them separately. First of all, let's start with top-down parsing, because that's considered, at least in the beginning, quite the intuitive way to do parsing. So, for that, we will going to introduce a particular automaton class that actually does that top-to-bottom exploring of the derivation tree, and for that we have this item pushdown automaton. That is the name for this class, and we will abbreviate that with this MLG. And what does it stand for? Well, the M is always the symbol for the automaton in there. Then we have the little L, that is the one that tells us that it is a leftmost derivation, so that's why that was so important. And The thing is that we will not have one generic automaton that does them all, but instead we will have different ones for each of the grammars that we are going to talk about, so we need to put an index for the grammar down there. So, no, not like this. This one. So, what it does is it reconstructs. Okay. So, the idea is how do we achieve this leftmost derivation? And, well, we will kind of literally follow the idea that we had for the derivation trees. And what we're going to use is we'll do term rewriting. So, for that, we will expand non-terminals always according to one of the rules of the grammar. What does expand mean? Well, it's possibly enlarging the syntax form that I'm working on right now. So that's why we're talking about expansions here, and that's the direct correspondence to the term rewriting. So you have to interpret that in that way. So we're going to rewrite non-terminals based on a certain rule. And the idea is that we're just going to optimistically start with that, and in the end try to somehow, as soon as we find that we have only terminals left, we will just try to verify that with the rule set that we took for expanding, that we actually match the input. Yeah, and so in order to do that, we somehow need to keep track how our current machine state corresponds to our rewriting process, and we can do so by not having just plain numbers as names for our states, but instead having a bit more of information in the labels for our states. So we are going to throw away the pure numbers, but instead we're going to use so-called items. An item, what is that? Well, that's essentially just a rule. That's where the connection to my rule set comes from, together with, once again, a bullet. That's going to flag us what part of the production we deem to be relevant for certain actions that will going to have to be performed next. We're going to see how that will work out. So items, for example, look like this. So here we have a general production with non-terminal A on the left-hand side. Becomes operator, and then a string of symbols on the right-hand side, a sub-string of that denominated with alpha, a sub-string of that denominated with beta, and the bullet marker. And that's a valid item in case that the combination of A, alpha, and beta actually can be found in the list of productions of our grammar. Okay. So, how do we have to interpret that? Once again, we're going to let the bullet circulate around another tree, like we did for the scanner generator. But this time, we're going to do that on the derivation tree. So instead of having numbers in there, I think I put up the symbols for the right-hand sides in these boxes now, but that's for purposes of keeping the bullet as a marker inside these right-hand side some way, so yeah, just that you know. The grammar that we're going to use for demonstration purposes is a very easy one, like this one here. It doesn't have any surprises. There's no, is even no non-determinism in there, so yeah, it's just for demonstration purposes. So let's start with the derivation tree. The different items that might arise will occur in that example, and yeah, let's just for once start with a specific one, namely the one that belongs to the root symbol, that's S, and we put the bullet in front of the complete right-hand side, so the bullet is in front of the A, and yeah, let this marker kind of run a depth first search top down, leftmost with leftmost priority through the whole derivation tree, and we'll see that the bullet has to somehow traverse the whole thing. Once again, we will have the bullet to the left, as we did for this scanner construction thing. We'll put it to the left as long as we haven't completely matched that subtree. So we'll keep it here as long as we haven't matched the subtree of A. Here we will continue with the subtree belonging to the right-hand side of A, which will be, then, in the end, finally match at, the input. So the input has matched. Now I can put the marker on here, on the right-hand side of the A. Now that this one is at the end of its right-hand side, I can now go up and finish with the symbol A and continue with the next one, which would be the B. So I have to descend to the right thing and do once again the same thing. So that is kind of the way that depth first search would go through the whole thing. And the states that are going to be relevant to the whole parsing or exploration of that derivation tree will be somehow related to these small bullets and the positions of these bullets within the right-hand sides of productions. How's that going to play out? Well, the end result is the one that you'll find here. So that is now, once again, a transition table of a pushdown automaton. You have the usual three components. You have the top of the stack, or top of the push down. You have the input part, and you have the part for the new top of stack. And now we're not talking about plain numbers anymore. Now we have this enhanced way of labeling our states, which are now items. Instead of having pure numbers as states, we have these items. We will introduce a start state, which will be, well, it's a technical thing now. It makes the thing is in order to have a unique entry point and exit point through our whole derivation tree, having alternative productions for the start symbol a little bit inconvenient. So in order to just deal with a singleton production with just one alternative for the right-hand side, the thing is that we would systematically just add another new rule to the whole rule set, which doesn't serve any purpose, instead for making the whole construction more easy because we only have to deal with one topmost production. So there's no deeper reason in that than just to facilitate the constructions that come below. So don't give it too much weight. It's just a technical thing that we're doing here. So we add that specific rule and say that the start state of our pushdown automaton now is the item that is associated with our new rule, and the marker, the flag, in at the beginning of the right-hand side, while we now only have one end state anymore, which is referring to the same rule, but now with a marker at the very end. And now you see why we have that we only have one end state to cover anymore. So that's a little bit more convenient. However, so how do typical transitions now look like? We now have one or several states now on the match the top of the of the push down part, and we might also rewrite the top of the stack with either one or two new states here. And we will follow certain principles with that. So what would be the typical principles for that? We will see them on the next slide and then go back once again to try to find out which of them correspond to which category. So there's three kinds of transitions. The most easy ones that you have seen so far is the ones that happen at the leaves of the derivation tree. There we only have to consume input. So these are the transitions also from our transition table, where these are the only ones that actually have an input symbol as their middle component. The other ones don't. So the ones that we're going to talk about is now the ones that match the actual input. They are called the so-called shifts, like this. Why is that? Well, that is because we somehow shift information from the input to the stack. So that's the intuitive meaning of that. So that's a shift of the item pushdown automaton. And what do we have to manipulate within the states? Well, remember that we have the states on the top of stack, so we have to look at the topmost stack or push down component. And in case of a read operation from the input, all I have to do is I have to actually check whether the input corresponds with the thing that I find coming directly after the marker. So here I have to check, and here I see a successful rule for that. In case that I have a rule where the bullet is exactly in front of the same symbol as I find in the middle component of my transition, I can safely move the bullet one place further and continue with that as my new top of stack instead of the state that I had before. So I do a simple transition of states, and I take a note that I have now passed a specific input symbol within that specific state. Okay? Good. Then what else can happen in a derivation tree? I can have two other processes in there. For once, I can go down or rewrite or do so-called expansions. So we have the expansions transitions, and we might finish with the subtree and go back up, and these are called reduce, so to say. So, but for now, let's talk first about expansions. Expansions are transitions that happen within the inner nodes of the derivation tree. And there, when going from inner node, we will traverse top bottom or bottom up. Anyway, which direction we will take, both of them don't touch the input. So for that, we will find epsilon in the component that consumes. So there's no consummation going on; it's just navigational transitions, either top or from top to bottom or bottom to top. In the expansion case, what we're going to do is we are going to be descending into the derivation tree by expanding a new non-terminal. How does that look like? Well, what I need here is the top of stack, and I have to examine the state that's going to be found there. And in case that the marker in that item is directly in front of a non-terminal, like this, I know that, well, so far I have treated everything that comes before, which was this alpha, well, like this, so I don't need to match with that anymore. But now I have a marker directly in front of a B. So the B is the next thing that I'm going to have to explore or to expand. So that's what I'm going to do. And I do that by keeping the old state on there, because I might need that later on to match with the things that follow after the B, which is the beta in there. But still, I want to expand. I want to go deeper. And I do that by adding a new thing on my pushdown, which is this one. And for that, I can choose amongst all the productions that are actually available for my non-terminal B within the productions. So I can use either of them. And that's what we're going to do. Then the other thing is reduces. This is the kind of inverted operation to expansion. So what I'm going to do is, in the end, I will take a number of states that I find on the top of pushdown. And in case that I find the situation like this, I find the topmost item to be one of the form where my marker is at the very end. That is an item that we call the complete item. Such an item means that I have completely visited or descended or expanded through all of the right-hand side symbols already. So that's kind of done. So it's due for removal. I have already explored everything, matched everything. I'm fine with that. So that's our candidate for removal. However, if I would just remove that without doing anything to its original rewritten non-terminal, then I will re-expand it again as soon as I have removed that. So I also need to somehow modify its context, which is found in the state directly below on the pushdown, namely here. No. This bullet in front of the B was the cause why I descended into that specific production. So now that I remove my closed item, what I'm going to do is I will put the marker now past this this symbol B, and yeah, continue on with a smaller stack. So that is the whole idea of this item pushdown automaton. Let's look back at how that looked for our example grammar. For example, consummation at the leaves of a derivation tree. Here is a transition, for example, that consumes. So what it needs to be on the left hand side is an item where the marker is directly left of that symbol that we have in the consummation part. And what we're going to do is we're going to put or replace the state with one where the marker has just advanced one step. No complications here. Same is for that situation where we consume a B. We will just shift the bullet from left to right. Shift operation. Good. So, the next ones were the expansion ones. Expansion always happens when we enlarge the number of states on my push down. So, for example, that one looks like a good candidate for expansion, and it actually is an expansion. Why is that? Well, for once, there's nothing consumed here, so it must be a navigational transition in my derivation tree. Also, I find the bullet in front of an S. Well, not an S, sorry. In front of a non-terminal. That means I still have to expand that non-terminal. And that's what I'm going to do here. I will keep the state for backtracking reasons on the pushdown and put a possible expansion on the stack also with the marker on the very left. Yeah, and just continue computing. And yeah, I have similar things like that on the stack. For example, here, where we have the bullet in front of A, I will add an A on there. here I have a bullet in front of a B, so I will add a B production over there, and yeah, same here. No, not this time. So these are the expansion ones. The other thing is that we have left is the reductions. So for each of the expansions, I also have a corresponding reduction, which is kind of the inverted operation. So for example, not like this. So that was the thing before. So for this expansion that produced that context, we will also find a transition on there which has the same items which speak about the same productions on the left part of our transitions, and the one will be this one here. The only difference between them is that when expanding, I put my bullet in front of the right-hand side of my child state. Now that I'm reducing once again, I will have to talk about complete items. So I will find the marker at the very end of my right-hand side. And yeah, the thing that we said that would happen is that we have, of course, navigational purpose. So there's just an epsilon transition over there. And yeah, this one is done, so candidate for removal. And the only thing that I have that has to happen is to rewrite the whole thing such that we have flagged that this thing is already visited. Very well. We can do that kind of a transition not only to this one, but also there's, for example, this transition over here, which also has two items on the left-hand side, the right of which is already complete. So what I do here is also just shift the bullet, which will create this one, and, of course, the last one. This one here, with this being complete, and the bullet to move to the middle. So it's always pairs. Each expansion has a reduction, and apart from that, every occurrence of a terminal symbol also has a shift as a corresponding transition in there. Fine. Okay, the expansions of the computation always happen in kind of a leftmost derivation. That's due to the characteristics of beginning with the bullet on the left-hand side of a reduction and then of a production, and then being shifted to the right. So that's how we can achieve a leftmost derivation. However, the thing that's still in there is, well, the whole goal was to somehow achieve a deterministic algorithm. So, still the expansions, at least which alternative I choose for expanding, is still something that's chosen non-deterministically. So, maybe we're still not completely finished with the whole thing. Also, there's still the question of whether the automaton that we constructed by that is actually really exactly the one that we wanted to have. For that, we would need to go into a formal proof and correlate the computation steps with the derivation steps, and yeah, matching them one-to-one would be the way to go for. But I think we're gonna not do that here. In principle, it would work like this. Anyway, what I said was that our goal was to create a deterministic algorithm, and there's certain approaches how to do that. And the whole topic of of doing that is the problem of LL parsing, where we have to somehow make the expansions of the item pushdown automaton deterministic. And there are several ideas how to do that. They're coming later on, I guess. So an example where we have non-deterministic behavior in an item pushdown automaton is the following. Here we see a very easy grammar with just two productions, but already there's an alternative in there. So that's that symbol over here, and that's the cause for the actual non-determinism. Can you spot a pair of transitions that are actually causing non-determinism in the whole thing?
Maybe 3 and 4.
3 and 4? Why is that? Well,
they have the same symbol, the same
pushdown state. Exactly. So you have, in this case, even no symbol at all, and the same top of stack, so both of them do match. Also, well, we could only have looked at that part, for example. That's also the same situation. So there's several cases for non-determinism already in that small automaton. So we somehow need to get rid of that. And there's several ways of doing so. The first thing, I don't know how much you are into, for example, natural language parsing. You might have encountered something like GLL parsing, which is generalized LL parsing. It uses the concept of an item pushdown automaton as a basic way of how to work. The only thing is that as soon as there's a conflict in terms of you have several choices non-deterministically there, what this thing does is conceptually it clones the complete pushdown automaton into two separate ones, and each of them follow different routes. Of course, you don't have to clone the complete machine. You can also simulate that by using flexible data structures where you just have pointers at the point where these two instances deviate from each other and manage that in a certain way. But that's all deep into this GLL parsing stuff. Other idea would be just say, well, I know that there's that this choice is non-deterministic, but, well, let's try with the left one. And just follow a certain strategy until we, in the end, see that all the things that we can match over there actually don't produce exactly our input that we have to match. And at that point, just backtrack and go the other branch in each case that we had several possible. So that is recursive descent and backtracking. Well, that works except for that if you always have non-terminals as the first symbols of the right-hand sides that you reach with that, well, you run into an infinite loop and you have to bound that and do some complicated stuff in order to circumvent that. And, well, that's a lot of technical engineering, but the idea that we want to use here is actually the third one, which is the recursive descent into the tree with certain additional power, with additional knowledge of look ahead. What we were going to do is we will do these recursive steps, these recursive derivations with always a certain fraction of the beginning of the input already in mind. And we will try to omit the choices that are actually bad for reaching the start of our input. So that would be the general idea. Yes, please?
But why go so much out of your own way to support these context-free grammars when you could just make a ranked grammar where the roots are ranked, like something like a parsing expression grammar? Wouldn't that... I always think about that as just being so much easier when I read about parsing, because
I think it's a matter of expressibility.
But parsing expression grammars can express every context-free grammar, so they're a superset. It's not proven that it's a superset, but it's not also not been disproven because no one has found a counterexample.
I'm just
asking myself, why go out of your way so hard if you could just do it a little simpler?
Maybe these ranks don't actually do what I think that they do, so maybe we should discuss that offline. Also, I think I should redo my research if that's really an alternative or not. But Well, there's one kind of way that you have to do that. I don't know. Maybe that's a real alternative. I have to read on that. But yeah, the thing that I find that are used in most of these parser generators are either, well, the famous ones, large ones that you encounter in the wild, are actually these LLK or LRK somehow. I would have to look into that, whether that's something that I should integrate in there to kind of compare. But I haven't done the comparison right now. Good. Well, anyway, I think we're probably already done, so let's... Or we're already quite late, so I think we will go deeper into this recursive descent and look ahead in the next lecture. So I hope you have a good week and have fun in the tutorial, and yeah, we'll see us next week. Goodbye.